Okay, we will proceed on with our final case of the afternoon. If the clerk would call the case, please.
What we now call Garrison Investment LLC, Anderson and Tyler Brown versus Lloyd Jones Capital LLC, the Acoustic Court. Mr. Andrew Levine will argue for the appellant. Mr. John H. Casey Jr. will argue for the appellate. Right.
Mr. Levine, you may proceed.
Good afternoon, and may it please the court. I know the panel is quite familiar with the TCPA. This case in particular concerns a senior housing property called Atlas Point, which was financed and is regulated under a HUD program called Section 21D. And if I could, I'd like to address two issues quickly, which I think may help frame the argument before I answer the questions that I'm sure the panel may have. The panel is going to need to reverse some of the findings of the district court, regardless, I think, of the opinion. The district court amicably disclosed during the hearing that this was the judge's first TCPA case, and that he did not have as much time as he would have liked in rendering his opinion. But nevertheless, the lower court found that three of the six claims fell within the ambit of the TCPA. And that's the first issue that I'd like to address quickly, which is because all of the claims arise from a common nucleus of facts, are connected to the same communications, under this court's opinion in DeAngelis, which Justice Gabriel joined in the opinion, the scope of free speech, one of the findings of that opinion was that the scope of free speech protection does not depend on the legal theory asserted by an inventive plaintiff. There the court was quoting the REHAC decision from the Houston Court of Appeal. And here, all of LJC's claims concern the same sort of collections of communications. They all concern discussions and efforts and negotiations and petitioning activity for approval for the acquisition of this property, the approval of a new manager for the property. And more pointedly than that, all of the claims have one common communication among all of them. There are many, and tab 7 of our handout, or rather tab 5 of our handout, which hopefully we have time to look at, tab 6 lists a number of communications. But the one I want to focus with first, which is a document, and it falls within the definition of communication in the statute, is what we call the non-binding term sheet. LJC has referred to it as the JV or joint venture agreement. And LJC refers to that document more than 18 times in their petition. They attach a version of that document to Exhibits 2, Exhibits 3, and Exhibits 4 of that agreement. And the problem for them with that document, and now we get to the second issue, which is what I think is another area where this court may need to disagree with the lower court, is that that document is fatal to their claims. And if we could, Exhibit 2, or Tab 2 to the handout, is the non-binding term sheet. And if you'll see in unambiguous and clear terms, which are highlighted in this handout, it makes clear that this term sheet is non-binding. It's non-binding, if you flip to the second page, CR 122, under the legal effect provision, it states explicitly, neither Garrison nor LJC will be legally bound in any manner unless and until such definitive management agreement has been executed by both parties.
Aren't you getting to the merits of this case before we've ever gotten past the first hurdle as to whether this act actually applies to this case?
I certainly am addressing the merits, and I'm happy to answer questions that you have about whether it falls within the ambit. As I said, we agree with the district court's decision that three of the claims fall within. We think, though, because all of the claims concern the same communications about a matter of what I think is undeniably public concern and importance and interest in health and safety and community well-being, which are the terms that are in the TCPA, I think that this is not one of those cases where that burden is as difficult as I'm sure you have heard before you, and I'm thinking in particular about the CALCAC
decision. Explain to me why this is a matter of public concern.
Sure.
What about this takes us out of a private transactional situation and places it into a public matter of concern?
Okay. I think it's undeniable that that senior housing, the welfare of the elders in our community, to have robust housing with community and programming is important.
This really wasn't senior housing, was it? This was not a assisted living facility or even something with higher care than that. This was for active people over 62.
Which is all that's required to gain approval and to be subject to financial benefits from HUD and regulatory oversight. But your Honor is correct. This is not a nursing home.
So
but this
every federally insured mortgage that HUD has anything to do with or the VA has anything to do with would qualify this for protection under the TCPA.
Well,
it's a private deal.
An answer to that, I think the answer to that is I don't think so. I don't think that every federal program, I don't think that Fannie Mae or Freddie Mac mortgages, for instance, would fall under it. Those are not public agencies. They're private agencies
but
which have public insurance.
Or insurer. VA or something like that.
Well,
that
I think,
your position.
I think the issue before us today, that's a broader issue that I'm prepared to be an expert on. But I think the issue today before us is that through the National Housing Act, Congress decided through the Section 221D program that they wanted to incentivize private developers to construct housing that's not as profitable as just constructing multifamily housing for anyone in the market. Excuse me. The elderly are specifically called out as a group if the elderly are over 62 years of age, that they qualify for that program. And that program is not simply, is my mortgage okay? And if you look at tab 4 of our handout, it's actually quite an extensive petition process. One for which, I may say, incidentally, that LJC alleges claims that we stole their lawyer, we stole their work product, we piggybacked on an incredible amount of work that they had done to begin that application process. And if you look at tab 4, which lays out some of the sort of hurdles that one has to go through to get approval, there are 22 categories of documents that an applicant who wants to get transfer a physical asset, which is one of the things that we needed to do, and attain approval to be a manager needs to go through, and a rigorous review process. And I think the petition prong of the TCPA, I'm not aware of a case that talks about how involved or onerous or unique the proceeding needs to be. The definition of in the statute, which, and I think we fall within both prongs, and this is at tab 3 of our handout, is under section 27.001, the exercise of the petition of the right to petition means a communication in or pertaining to, and we've excerpted three of the categories. I think subsection 3, an executive or other proceeding before the federal government. I think there's no doubt that the application process, that response to questions and follow-up questions, that the submission of documents and information qualifies as a proceeding. But if there were any doubt, subsection B simply says, and this court needs to apply the plain language of the statute, that a communication in connection with an issue under consideration or review by a legislative, executive, judicial, or other government body, certainly HUD falls within that category. Certainly they are considering the approval process. So I think that we actually certainly fall in quite easily under the petitioning prong and under the court's ruling in CalCAC, and I apologize.
Are there any communications with HUD that form the basis of the complaint?
Your Honor, I think there are.
All we are dealing with are private communications, not formal communications with HUD.
So, Your Honor, the allegation and an argument, and I can look while I'm there in the reporter's record where counsel argued before the district court, was that one of the things that we had done is that we stole their lawyer so that we could gain an advantage by piggybacking on the work that they had done in the TPA application process. And there are communications in the record. There were questions at deposition about that exact about the petitioning process, about Garrison gathering documents, getting legal advice, making the applications to HUD.
But the cause of action that's asserted, none of the causes of action actually say that there was any interference whatsoever with your ability to petition HUD to transfer the mortgage.
I'm sorry, I don't quite understand. Interference with our?
Yeah, the whole point is to make sure that you can, in fact, petition the government, and there was no actual interference with your ability to petition the government.
To the contrary, Your Honor, what their claim is that they had an agreement to be, they had an agreement that we agreed to and to be bound by, which is not on the record.
Did they file anything with HUD that challenged your petition for the transfer of the mortgage?
I'm not aware of that, but I also don't think that's a requirement for us to fall within the statute. I think that our petitioning to HUD is implicated because they are alleging that by not selecting them as manager, and they were already HUD approved, by not putting them on the HUD applications for the transfer of this asset, not having them serve as the manager who must be approved, and there's a regulatory agreement and obligations to update HUD about what you're doing, they're alleging that our decision not to use them, i.e. our petitioning decision not to use them, violated their rights. It's at the heart of their claims.
But nothing about their filing suit actually interfered with your petitioning HUD for the transfer, and in fact, the transfer occurred.
I think that's correct, but with all due respects, I don't think that that's dispositive of the issue. I think that all that we need to show to fall within the ambit of the statute is that there are communications at issue relevant to the pleadings that have a connection to the claims. And I think there's no doubt that their claim that we had to use them as manager and that we stole their beginnings of HUD work satisfies that burden. If I may, getting back to the non-binding term sheet, and again, I'm happy to answer any more questions about the scope, about us falling within the statute. I do think that we clear that hurdle. I think the district court got it half right, but should have found all claims fell within it. But as to the merits, if you look at tab 5, pardon me, I'm having trouble with my tabs. Tab 7, you will see that each of the six claims that they allege depend on a finding that this non-binding term sheet either created binding obligations that Garrison was duty-bound to fulfill lest they be found to be breach, or that representations made in this induced their reliance. And I would submit to the court that a document that says there's no legally binding obligation, that you're not going to get paid unless there's a definitive agreement, can't possibly support the reliance and expectation requirements of their promissory estoppel, unjust enrichment, and fraud claims. And I think that each of their claims is squarely defeated by the non-binding term sheet. I'll just call while I have a moment for your edification. Tab 8 is a player's list of the key players in the communications here. Tab 6, we identify some of the protected communications alleged in the petition. And tab 5, which is particularly important, is we dispel the myth that communications in March, while we were discussing a equity proposal that LJC walked away from and signed the PSA with a third party as their equity partner, are in any way relevant or in any way support their claims regarding the non-binding term sheet, which was executed after LJC had cut us out of the deal, after they had signed an agreement with somebody else, after they terminated that agreement and came back to us. The one other thing I would note is there's been much made about secret communications during the period while the LJC PSA was in effect. If you look at Exhibit 5, the bottom box on the first page, the sum total of those communications is an email and a text message to set up a short phone call between Garrison and Overlook's point of contact to simply say, it was nice to meet you, maybe we can do business sometime in the future. There were no covert efforts to frustrate the deal. They simply pulled out of the deal because they didn't think that there were enough seniors who were going to lease this housing. Thank you, Your Honor. That was weak. Thank you.
Mr. Casey.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. May it please the Court. Sitting with me at council table is my co-counsel, Will Tishkoff, from Michigan. He didn't bring the cool weather with him, unfortunately, but he's appearing here pro hoc vici. I'm going to do something that I've never done before, and if the Court will allow me to take a few minutes to explain why I believe the motion to dismiss is frivolous on its face, and I don't use that term lightly. I'll yield the remainder of my time to the Court and, of course, answer any questions the Court may have. But I first want to answer a couple of questions or comments that Justice Gabriel brought up. First, the 221D program is not specifically designed to provide housing to the elderly, as that term is defined in the government report. According to the authority that the appellants, their own authority that they cite, which is a HUD handbook, this loan program simply is designed to assist private industry in providing attractive rental properties to middle-income families. Seniors, as that term is defined, qualifies a family as well as other categories. So it's no different than any other federal insured loan program. I mean, I'm a senior citizen according to these HUD classifications, and if I purchased my next home with the VA loan, which I could do, I would find myself falling under the provisions of the Act. That's how absurd the position is that they've taken here. And of course, as Justice Gabriel pointed out, this property is not an assisted living property. It's not a nursing home. It's not adult daycare. It is a premier resort style property for baby boomers. It's very nice. So it simply is not what they characterize it to be. But let me also be clear about something here. No one on our side of this case disputes the laudable purposes behind the former or the current anti-SLAPP statute to safeguard the rights of persons to exercise their free speech and petition or association, and at the same time, to protect persons to file meritorious lawsuits. I completely agree with Justice Pemberton's concurrence in Serafine, where he mentioned the fact that a true anti-SLAPP suit is an especially pernicious form of lawsuit abuse. But what numerous courts have recognized, as well as this court, over the 8 years or so that this act has been in effect, is that the former version of the anti-SLAPP statute had itself become a form of lawsuit abuse. The cure, if you will, in some respects had become the disease. Just last year, this court in the in Telecentrics case noted how problematic it is when a movement's entitlement to bring a motion to dismiss is dubious or without merit, yet the movement files one anyway. And I believe this case is a perfect illustration of that, and here's why. In Smith versus Crestview, this court, speaking through Justice Gabriel, held that the purpose of the TCPA is to protect communications made by the movement, not conduct, but communications, in furtherance of their free speech, association, and petition rights. And of course, as the court well knows, that the protection, that the movement has the burden of proving by preponderance of the evidence whether that communication falls under the protection of the statute. Under the authority cited by both sides in this case, that burden logically entails identifying the specific communication that the movement is contending falls under the protection of the statute, but also showing that the communication has some relationship to the legal action. Both Justice Basil in the Kalkak decision and Justice Gabriel in Cressfield recognized that burden and how it plays into this. And we know from two very recent decisions of the Dallas Court of Appeals that were decided in August of this year, the Shields and Shetty decisions, that vague, indeterminate, obscure, broad brush references to undefined communications is not enough to meet that burden. Now, if you'll turn to tab A of our oral argument handout, and also turn to the appellant's handout, the table that they provide under tab 6, what you'll find is nowhere in either of those handouts, tab A of our handout is excerpts from the appellant's motion to dismiss, which includes every arguable reference that they make in their motion to a communication that they say falls under the Act. And then, of course, their handout, tab 6, is a list of 10 or so communications that they say fall under the Act. But nowhere in either of those handouts will you find a description of any specific communication made by the appellants in furtherance of these three rights that the Act protects. All you're going to see there are vague, indeterminate references to unidentified communications. Now, we made that point in our briefs, but here's something that we didn't realize until we were preparing for argument. If you'll turn to page 3, which is the first page, page 3 of the motion to dismiss, under tab A of our handout. It's the first page under that handout. There highlighted is a sentence that I believe constitutes a fatal confession to the appellant's TCPA argument in this case. There you'll see the appellants expressly and unequivocally deny making any of the communications that they allege the appellee's claims are based upon. They state, and I quote, LJC's entire case is predicated on alleged representations or commitments which the Garrison parties never made. If this shows anything, it shows that this motion is nothing more than an artfully drafted sham. I don't know of any case, any reported case in this state in which the movement was brazen enough to deny making the very communications that they rely on to support dismissal of a claim under the TCPA. What the appellants are trying to do here is have it both ways, and they can't do that. Certainly the court would not allow them to do that. They can't, on the one hand, claim that all of these communications that we refer to in our pleadings are communications protected under the Act, and on the other hand, deny ever making those statements or representations or communications. Those are two fundamentally inconsistent positions. Now, I have no doubt they're going to try to walk that back on rebuttal.
So you're essentially saying that because they deny ever making communications, then those are not things that can be protected constitutionally?
Exactly. Essentially, yes, Your Honor. They have cited communications that we refer to in our pleadings as communications that are protected under the Act, but in their motion, they deny that they made those communications. They deny that they made those representations. There's no other case in this that I've seen that has that kind of situation. And of course, it's just simply an outrageous position to take, quite frankly. And it's the reason why there's been so much criticism of the Texas Citizens Protection Act, at least in its former form to date. But even if the appellants try to walk that back, which I'm sure they'll do, here's a problem they have, and they've had it throughout this case. And it's been a problem for us in trying to brief in response to their claims. There's no indication of the content of the communication that they are saying that falls under the Act. And without that, how can the court determine what specific communications the appellants are talking about and what, if any, relationship these vague, indefinite references to communications, what relationship do they have to the legal claims that we made? At best, all the court could do is speculate as to what communications out of these host of negotiations and back and forth that they loosely refer to. The court can only speculate what communication they're talking about, whether that's a protected communication or it's an unprotected communication. And of course, as the court knows from, as it said in Bevings versus Beatles, if you've got a mix of protected and unprotected, you can't dismiss all the claims anyway. But the court's just left with speculation as to what they are talking about. And the court in Beatles said that is not something it will do under any circumstances. So, Your Honors, for this and all the other reasons that we have laid out in our briefs, we would ask the court to affirm the trial court's order. And if the court has no other questions, I'll yield the remainder of my time.
Let me ask you something. Basically, the NSLAP is aimed at kind of lawfare, using litigation as a means of impairing the three rights that are set forth in the statute itself, that I'm going to sue you because in suing you, I may cause you to refrain from doing something that you're constitutionally protected from doing. It's lawsuit abuse, lawfare, that type of thing. Here, the reason I was asking about HUD, let me ask you this. If, in fact, this lawsuit had been filed, for example, if there was something, and I don't see it in the application for transfer, okay, but if there, for example, we know that a lot of times in a federal regulatory situation, they have open public comments about whether or not something should or should not be done. A lot of times with regard to mergers, things of that nature that the government has interest in. But I don't see that type of thing here. But if, in fact, there was an open public comment, okay, and it would be viewed as the lawsuit was being used to influence the public comment, which would then, in fact, be impairing the right to petition, because then HUD might decide we're not going to approve this transfer because we're catching flack about it.
Yes.
Do you know anything with regard to record that whether it would be some type of public analysis or public awareness of this particular transaction?
Well, Judge, I mean, you've described a set of facts that, of course, that's not this case, but under which I think there might be an arguable basis for claiming that a communication falls under the statute. But here, let me just tell you how far off that hypothetical is from our case. They filed their application for the HUD loan, I believe, sometime in June of 2018, I think. We filed our lawsuit in August, okay? The HUD loan application process was going on and did not conclude and close until October, well after the lawsuit had been filed. Of course, you can look at our pleadings and you can see that there's nothing, we don't complain at all about the HUD loan application, the HUD loan process, the fact that this was financed by HUD or backed, insured by HUD. That has nothing to do with our fraud and tort claims. But I think that just the chronology of the events, with they make their application for the loan in June, we file suit, and then I believe that the evidence shows that they reinitiated the loan because they kicked us out of the deal.
Well, let me modify it a little bit, okay? So they filed their application. They've got a duty to update their applications, okay? They do have to provide financial information with regard to that. I don't know, does the financial information they have to provide, do they have to update it and say, we've been sued for liability with regard to that? And that might be, in fact, a use of a lawsuit to influence a petition of the federal government with regard to a matter under the circumstances.
Well, there's no evidence of that here, Your Honor, and I don't know that I'd want to. I haven't thought about that. It's a good question.
I'm kind of looking at it, and basically the analogy is HUD appears to be the minister, and y'all are griping about who got left at the altar, but it had nothing to do with the minister. Okay, so.
Yeah. Well, it had nothing that I will absolutely agree with that. It had nothing to do with who the minister was or how old the folks were that resided in this property. So would I have any other questions?
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Justice Brewer, I'd like to respond to your hypothetical.
That's why I asked
you. Yes. I think sort of, obviously the TCPA is broader than constitutional law, than the First Amendment. But a tenet of the First Amendment is chilling, right? We protect people's rights to petition, to speak, to associate, not because some damage will be visited on them later on, or not just from some damage that will be visited on them later on, denial of their HUD application.
Explain to me how this lawsuit chilled anything with regard to your interaction with HUD with regard to the transfer here.
Okay. So again, the HUD overlay is, in order for the property to be transferred, in order for the PSA to close, the transfer needs to be approved and a new manager of the property needs to be approved. If LJC prevails, we will be penalized in whatever the damage claim that they try and prove up. I submit they can't prove any. But whatever the damage claim they prove up, we will be penalized for doing what the Constitution and what the TCPA protects us to do, which is petition the government to take under consideration an application, associate in the common interest, and this court's decision in Caucac described the common interest as something more than two joint feasors getting together to engage in criminal conduct. There's no doubt that trying to develop and manage a senior living home is something of more value than that. And communications regarding how to set up a senior living facility. And if they prevail, we will be chilled because what we will be told is, you signed essentially a letter of intent with these people to give them a tryout to see if they would be a good partner to manage your property. They disappeared and didn't provide you anything of value during the due diligence period. But you cannot go on and be with somebody who may be good at that job to provide a robust senior living community without paying them a ton of money. So it's the chilling effect on our ability to associate, to speak, and to petition the government for approval in the way that we would like to and in the way that we're not bound not to, because there's no agreement here not to. I'd like to address very quickly, if I could, the comment when I appreciate the lawyer argument, we all engage in it in our motion to dismiss. I don't know how the court would rule if a defendant denied allegations. Certainly defendants deny allegations all the time. The import of the sentence that was quoted there is to say, we deny the allegations that we did things, that our communications, which are in the record, some are summarized in our handout, they're in the record and summarized in the briefs. We deny they mean what they say they mean. We deny we lied to them. We deny we ever entered into an agreement with them that bound us to keep them as our property manager. We deny that we induced them in any way. And the term sheet makes that plain, because no matter how much they have tried to point to other documents, and below they argued in response to questions from the district court judge, wait one second, is the joint venture agreement something different than the term sheet? They argued that there were other emails that evidence that, and there are none in the record. On the HUD issue, I'd like to say the HUD handbook, which they cite and is available online in their SIR reply, makes clear that the elderly above 62 years of age, by Congress's intent, are subject to and benefit from the Section 221 program. There is no requirement or limitation that it be assisting living. That's not how Congress intended the program to work. That's not how it has been administered. So yes, more active seniors can live in facilities that are constructed with HUD financing and that fall underneath the Section 221 program. I think the real question here is, and again, I'm going to turn back just for the last moment to the merits, is where are the documents and the evidence that show that my client did anything other than enter into a letter of intent with a potential partner to help develop and manage this senior housing facility? Letters of intent, which have clear language that say that they're not binding, are not binding. If they weren't, our dealing in commercial contracts would fall apart. And I would submit that there's nothing in the statute or in any of the cases that prohibit a finding that the TCPA applies to commercial transactions so long as they implicate matters of public concern and petitioning activity. Thank you very much for hearing the argument, Your Honor.
Thank you, Counsel.
Thank you very much for your arguments and your briefs and your handouts and your amended SIR reply briefs and everything else that you sent us.
I'm not going to thank you for the handouts.
No. Okay. Okay, your case is submitted and you're now excused. Thank you.